Hello, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. You are listening to KGBM, Bozeman Community Radio, broadcasting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgbm.org. I'm Roxana, and this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. Happy February to you. We've been enjoying some mild winter days, but they say the weather's going to turn again. We could always use more snow, right? Well, David Lynch gets credit for this quote. Through the darkness of future past, the magician longs to see one chance out between two worlds. Fire walk with me. Well, Ken Lane has used that quote as inspiration to title his latest episode of Desert Oracle Radio. It covers a lot of territory, and he released it late on January 25th, 2025. Here is One Chance Out Between Two Worlds.
Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night is fallen on the desert, another cold, cold winter night. Cold all over America this week. I saw New Orleans got more than a foot of snow. A foot of snow in New Orleans. In all the years I lived down there, we only ever got a scraggly-ass, mushy inch or so one time, exactly one time. And I remember we scooped up as much as we could, as fast as we could do it. It was mostly grass and dirt. To make a little snowman about 4 inches tall, sort of a snow gnome. But this week, I saw a video of dogs playing in the snow while people were laughing and throwing snowballs on Bourbon Street. Not the kind of snowballs you get in the summertime with the flavored syrup made of crushed ice, but the winter kind most people never ever see unless they leave southern Louisiana. Actual snow. Nice to see. Nice to see after what that street and that town went through just a few weeks ago when the year was still very new. Well, there really is a time for everything. As hard as that can be when the hard times come to you, come for you, come to your people. I was over at my friend Herbie's the other night. We were playing some old country spirituals together with those Appalachian harmonies that sound like the bagpipes, or the bagpipes sound like those ancient haunting melodies. Those melodies we sang in the old times, long before sheepskins were converted into musical instruments. Maybe even before Pan's pipes were cut from river reeds and wildwood. Long before the time of bronze. So we were talking about how those good old country gospel numbers feel kind of right about now. Something you can do without the CCP surveillance app on your phone. Play an old song. If you don't remember all the words, all the chords, just fill it in with what sounds natural. Which is the reason why favorite song of old will have 100 recorded versions over the years. Many of them hits, many with greatly varied tempos, melodies, lyrics, titles. The Gypsy Laddie of 17th century English broadsides becomes Warren Smith's Sun Records ghost chant Blackjack David in the 1950s. In every variation, the fair-haired maiden goes off with Johnny Fay, Jack Frost, Black-haired Davy, whatever the name. Last night she slept in a fine feather bed next to her husband and baby. Tonight she sleeps on the cold, cold ground with old Blackjack Davy. I have loved that song ever since I tracked it down. I'm talking about the Warren Smith version. On a Truck Stop Sun Records compilation cassette in the early 1980s, not long after reading Nick Tosh's book Country, The Biggest Music in America, which tells the long and twisted tale of Blackjack David, Blackjack Davy. From his origins in Greek underworld mythology to the Norman Trouvères and Burgundy Troubadours to Appalachian folk ballads to a slinky rockabilly shuffle by the guy who wrote You Bangy Stomp. And speaking of rockabilly and that particular style of candy apple red streamlined mid-century Americana, the owner of the most beautiful natural pompadour of the late 20th and early 21st century has passed away, as you surely know, just a few days ago now. I love the America that David Lynch loved, that he lovingly captured and preserved and revived, especially in Twin Peaks, which came at a time when the rare beauty and unique aesthetic of the United States was being abandoned and replaced with plastic letters on stucco strip mall signs. Log cabin lodges with big buck trophies on the wood-paneled walls, a fire crackling, donuts lined up on the long wooden conference table alongside the coffee urn. That shot-on-location, self-contained movie released as the pilot episode of Twin Peaks sort of reset the culture for a while. I guess that 1980s into the early 90s were overall a kind of reaching back to the golden age we could still see the ghost of on the afternoon television reruns. Davy Crockett, Mary Tyler Moore, Ronald Reagan on Death Valley days. There was even a rockabilly revival that made the pop charts. Girls wore poodle skirts and saddle shoes. Boys wore tight Levi's and tall pompadours. If you're looking around the cultural landscape today and realizing the last giants are passing on, well, you are right. That's how it goes. Every 100 years, all new people.
Desert Oracle Radio.
Design for Disaster. The story of the Bel Air conflagration. Santa Ana. Indians named it Santana, the devil wind. When it blows, plants wither, trees and brush become crackling dry. Atmosphere grows tense, oppressive. People tire easily, argue more. Even the suicide rate rises during the months of the Santa Ana. Warm, dry. This climate plays an important part in attracting over 3,000 people a month to the city of Los Angeles. And some move up to the scenic, secluded hill areas, where lush California vegetation softens the ridges and valleys for miles in every direction, and breezes blow clean through native growth. And increasingly strong during the late fall months of the Santa Ana, and dangerously dry when there has been no rain. It is during this unstable period that firemen most fear the potential. The potential of 134 square miles of thick, dry chaparral and oak, all within the city boundaries of Los Angeles, classed by experts as the fastest burning ground cover in the Western Hemisphere. Nestled in their cover, one of the greatest concentrations of high-value homes in America. A serious problem in fire protection under even the best of conditions. On the morning of November 6, 1961, fire department dispatches find conditions far from the best. Santa Ana winds are strong, gusty. Humidity and moisture content of the brush rock bottom. Fire danger, extreme. At 8.03 a.m., a condition of high hazard is declared throughout the department. Standby companies are moved up to stations near brush areas to strengthen the circle of protection. But even as they move, trouble strikes. At 8.15, an alert of fire is relayed to the officer in command of Mountain Firefighting Unit.
Mountain Patrol and all units concerned. They reported brush fire in the mountain area, 3600 block Stone Canyon.
The division chief responds immediately. Clouds of brush smoke are already visible on the ridge. The chief calls for additional companies. The fire, starting from its point of origin north of Mulholland on Stone Canyon, spreads out along canyon walls in three directions. First arriving units succeed in stopping it on the north, east, and west flanks before it reaches threatened homes. But there is no stopping it on the south. Winds are driving the flames fast and hard toward Mulholland. The chief declares a condition of major emergency. The master plan of defense against a serious brush fire begins. Support from air tankers is requested. 15 additional engine companies roll up. All key personnel are alerted and special mountain firefighting equipment dispatched. Deputy and division chiefs move up to take command of field units as radio messages crackle in.
Your fire is over the top. It's heading straight down Storm Canyon.
Engine 31, 45, 46, and 67 move directly into the fire.
Fire has jumped Mulholland at the crest of the Santa Monica. It's headed toward Bel Air. To these men, brush fires are routine, but this one is pushing them hard. The flames take a run along the canyon slopes, heading uphill toward the ridges. Firemen with high-pressure hose streams knock the fire down as it tries to make the jump as it did over Mulholland. But in the canyon between, along the wide sweep of fire front traveling unchecked with the wind, there lies the problem. Rough terrain impedes fire crews in meeting the flames head-on. Fire fans out to sweep up canyon walls, threatening residential areas ahead. Chief Engineer William Miller arrives at Command Post Headquarters to take charge of fire operations. A quick size-up of conditions prompts him to order everything available into the fire. Time is vital. Fire is spreading, growing by the minute. Air tankers sweep in. Fire danger is compounded by ground winds, the Santa Ana, driving through at 50 miles an hour to hurl burning brands ahead of the main front. 100, 200, 300 feet ahead, other blazes are starting, spot fires that appear from nowhere. All off-duty firemen are recalled to hold back what may come if the wind plays tricks. And the wind does. Embers blow ahead of the fire to fall on the opposite side of Roscommon. Fire is now west of Stradella, out of Stone Canyon.
There's a fire on the west side of Roscommon, and it jumped at least 500 feet further south.
Fire has jumped Roscommon at about Donella, and Roscommon is now out of control.
Responding apparatus is directed in by helicopter. Defense forces are split once again to handle the two additional fronts. As equipment and manpower thin out, fire grows with the wind, and flames begin spreading at the rate of 13 acres per minute. Badly needed help has come from county firefighting units. 22 of their engine companies and patrol rigs are at the fire. 10 more are on the way. Fire officials decide where residents may remain, where they may not. Decisions are based on the prime consideration in any fire, safety to human life. Ahead of the fire, police officers are hard-pressed to control the evacuation of residents. While they work, Radios blare out messages of trouble.
In Kenner Canyon, we need police assistance here to evacuate these people. We are going to lose some civilians if we don't get them out of here.
There's a lady here having difficulty breathing. She's been sick and trapped in this fire.
We have a school bus trapped, 2425 Ross Comer Road. The children are out, the driver and the bus are trapped.
We've got a report of four people trapped on foot between Chelan and Ross Comer. We need help from the police department.
Send an ambulance to 2025 Stradella Road. An injured fireman.
8 and 50 Linda Flora. The house is on fire and there's a lady trapped.
Sightseers add to the problems. Police are forced to arrest many who move in to get a ringside view of disaster. And disaster it is. In the canyons, along the hillsides, on the ridges, houses are burning.
Dear friends, it has been nearly a year since we lost our outlaw country gin-guzzling frenzied brother-in-arms, Mojo Nixon. If you missed it, there's a whole episode of this radio show called The Ballad of Mojo Nixon that you can easily find that explains the situation in plain language. Plus some good sound clips from the time when Mojo exploded onto the scene. Went from a mushroom maniac threatening horrific acts upon MTV VJs to a paid performer on MTV preaching to the multitudes. I hear he also played something called The Toad in an otherwise forgotten live-action movie about the 80s video arcade game Donkey Kong. Anyway, on this coming February 8th, that's Saturday at noon on February 8th, 20 and 25, the Whistle Stop in San Diego's South Park will be showing the fantastic documentary, The Mojo Manifesto. And after that, we are gonna do some Mojo songs, and by we, I mean you. If you have a song, a track by Mojo that you love and want to perform at this special one-year anniversary memorial remembrance of the late, great Mojo Nixon, who passed away aboard the Outlaw Country boat after his wild last concert, surrounded by family and friends and musical legends. On February 8th of last year, well, show up and sign up. Who knows, I might even be carrying the sign-up sheet on the clipboard with the pen taped to the string and the whole deal. So come on down to the Whistle Stop if you're in the area, and we'll pay our respects to Mojo Nixon and I guess complete the year of mourning that is required. And speaking of music that moves the soul, on this radio show, Desert Oracle, we are lucky to have these soundscapes, which are composed and performed by Red Blue, Black Silver. And speaking of those mesmerizing back roads and beauty shots of the waterfall and the forests and the mountains of the Pacific Northwest, I believe this radio program is still heard on Sunday nights at 8 p.m. on Valley 104.9 FM Community Radio out of Carnation, Washington, King County. Go get yourself a slice of pie and a cup of coffee at the diner. Oh yeah, you can pick up this radio show the whole drive up. Sundays at 8 p.m. And in Joshua Tree, Yucca Valley, 29 Palms, Pioneer Town, Landers. Did I leave out anything? Maybe I left out Wonder Valley. Friday nights at 10 p.m. on Z107.7 FM, KCDZ, community radio in the high desert. It was sort of nice to see the people online kind of agree on something for once, because they all pretty much love David Lynch, or at least pretend to, now that he's gone. Oh yeah, there were the usual scolds showing up to ruin the memorial, saying David Lynch was bad news for promoting transcendental meditation, like it's a bad thing to sit down for 15 minutes and clear your mind and breathe. As every sane and or creative person does a couple of times a day, regardless if it's formal prayer or meditation, or a quiet walk in the woods, the welcoming woods, the dark forest. Ultimately, of course, a bunch of forgettable, consensus-produced corporate garbage media properties, intellectual properties, will always have a larger audience and make more money than the very individual work of a dedicated artist who plugs away at his or her craft for half a century, ignoring fads and phases, making lemonade from life's lemon tree. Like David Lynch did with Mulholland Drive, which started off as the pilot for an ABC television spinoff of Twin Peaks, following the character Audrey Horne as she moves to Hollywood to become an actress. And then that turned into a rejected pilot episode that followed the mysterious Movieland adventures of Betty and Rita and etc. And was finally finished with French Money as a standalone feature film that won Lynch the Best Director Award at Cannes. When Life Gives You Lemons, etc. There will not be another David Lynch, proud Eagle Scout from Missoula, Montana, and sole practitioner of a deeply Mountain West-inspired American surrealism. But there will be other things made by other people whose ears are tuned to the muses, to the great cosmic radio that whispers to those of strong heart and open mind. It is still early in the year, and the good news, the gospel truth, is that the kingdom of heaven is here around us, and generally we do not see it. Sometimes because some very real horrors are all around us. Other times we just don't see it because we're used to not appreciating the times when the times are not the bad times, the dark times. You know it's here. You know where to find it. That's why you make the time to walk in the desert, walk in the woods, plod up the mountains, shuffle along the shore. Well, that's why you row the kayak or sit all day on the riverbank, sort of fishing, but mostly communing with the natural world. that's still out there, still close at hand. But that's why we fall in love, raise our children, talk to our dogs, brush our teeth. It's worth it, generally speaking, it's worth it. Times of strife and change are also the times of the greatest creative energy, like the oft-ridiculed Middle Ages, the so-called Dark Ages. Like the good old monks of times past, now is the time to protect and nourish the beautiful, the intellectual, the philosophical, the spiritual. We will do it in various ways, as people always do. But let's just not forget to do it. Because it makes everything better. That's no lie. From Amboy to Zyzix, broadcasting across the Great Mojave Wilderness, this is Desert Oracle, soundscapes by Red, Blue, Black, Silver. Visit our website at desertoracle.com. Thanks to our supporters who keep this commercial-free radio show alive and kicking at patreon.com/desertoracle. If you don't like these online patronage systems, the Substacks and the Whatsits and the Venmos and the Zellos and etc., that's more than okay. I don't know how all this happened, frankly, and I'm just waiting for it to fade away. Like another 100 things that rose up to prominence without our approval or consent. You ever hear about some character being arrested or otherwise sunk by scandal before you ever knew what they did or why we were supposed to pay attention? You'll sort of slowly develop a background cognizance of something called Dr. Monster or some such, and a couple of years later, you'll see the trending news about Dr. Monster launching a meme coin that resulted in his permanent imprisonment in Libya. Just dire stuff out there. The wolf of consequences again at the door. Anyway, if you want to support the show the old-fashioned way without the 5% or 10% credit card fees and merchant fees and convenience charges, find your checkbook. You got one somewhere. Send us a plain old personal check to P.O. Box 1735, Joshua Tree, California, 92252. That's the Desert Oracle Post Office Box celebrating its 10-year anniversary at our weird post office here that locks up the lobby when the counter closes at 5 p.m. sharp on weekdays, completely negating the point of having a post office box. But we get in there before 5 o'clock now and then to liberate the U-Line catalogs and occasional piece of mail from a fellow human being. Snow is coming to the Southern California coast and mountains and deserts, that's the promise. Might just be some cold rain, oh, we'll take that too. Thank you for listening, and good night from the voice of the desert.
It's the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay on KGVM 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio. This week has been a busy one on the calendar. The Lunar New Year was January 29th this year and marks a time of renewal, prosperity, and celebration across many Asian cultures, with 2025 ushering in the Year of the Snake. Imbolc was celebrated on Saturday, February 1st this year. Imbolc is a time to welcome the first stirrings of spring and honor the goddess Brigid. It's a festival of renewal, fire, and fertility, marking the midpoint between the dark of winter and the light of spring. Lunar Imbolc is often considered to be at the new moon closest to that halfway point, and that new moon was on January 29th. Oh, and February 2nd is Groundhog Day. I celebrate our local marmots that day. And coming up is February 14th, which always puts me in the mood for chocolate. So I interviewed a couple chocolate makers in Livingston this week. Today I'm at Front Porch Chocolate in Livingston, Montana, and I'm here with T and Greg. And would you guys like to tell me a little more about yourselves?
Yeah. Hi, I am T. I am the co-maker here at Front Porch Chocolate along with Greg. I'm originally from the Philadelphia area and have found Montana to be home and chocolate to be a passion.
And I'm Greg. I'm the other co-maker with T. And I've been in the Bozeman area for 5 or so years. We just recently moved to Livingston, and I'm an MSU grad and a Studio Coffee alum, and happy to be making chocolate in Livingston.
First off, how did you come up with the name of your business?
Believe it or not, we were sitting on our front porch, and T was asking me what I like to do, and I was like, well, like sitting on the front porch. And we started thinking about why and everything that went in with sitting on the front porch. It was about relaxing. It was about spending time by yourself or with friends or listening to music. It was a way that you could unplug a little bit and not have to tend to the day-to-day and not deal with like whatever was going on in your life. If you were on the front porch, you were really relaxed. So we really liked the image of that. And then we had our first sale we ever did was right off our front porch in Bozeman. We lived right on 19th, so it was a very central location. So we had our first sale off our front porch, and yeah, we just stuck with it.
So do you guys each have a backstory?
Well, our backstory, how I got to Montana is a fun backstory. I was living in Colorado working at a ski area, and I was doing marketing for them and kind of just playing outdoors, figuring out what I like to do. And I had met Greg through my roommate, who was Greg's childhood friend, Jimmy, and he introduced us in like 2019 over the phone. And then in the beginning of COVID, Greg and I just started talking on the phone a bunch and forming a relationship. And I had never been to Bozeman or Montana before, and I thought, I think I'm gonna drive up there and meet Greg and see, you know, if there's something for us. And I drove up and I pretty much never left. And then he was making chocolate and we decided to start doing it together. So it's kind of, yeah.
And Greg?
Yeah. Gosh, where to begin? I mean, I guess my backstory is, I mean, as it pertains to Front Porch Chocolate, I very early on wanted to pursue food. My mom didn't cook very much, so I had to sort of figure out how to cook. My dad was a really good cook, so I fell in love with the process and fell in love with cooking. And I dropped out of school originally. My first go around, the first time I tried school, I dropped out to pursue a culinary path. I didn't go to culinary school, but I wanted to be a chef. And so I started cooking in a restaurant in Tennessee, and very quickly found out that I hated it. Mm-hmm. And just didn't enjoy restaurant life, specifically back of house and specifically cooking in a restaurant. So conveniently or poetically, that restaurant burned down. And so it was a nice little like push away from that world, and then stayed in restaurants, worked as a server and then for a long time, and then got into coffee and worked in coffee for a very long time in Boulder and Whitefish, and then most recently at Studio in Bozeman. So food and coffee were always a part of what I did, and then chocolate felt like a natural extension of all of those things. It was a way that I could explore flavors and explore producing a unique food that could really change people's perception of something that already existed. And so I really liked that. And then T and I, you know, when we like first started forming our relationship together, chocolate was like, I mean, chocolate's pretty romantic, so.
Yes.
Like it naturally is going to come up early on. And so, yeah, it was an early conversation piece and always was lingering around like chocolate this, you know, like that's, it became something that was interesting for the two of us to pursue together as we, you know, built our relationship.
Yeah. And I can still remember the first chocolate bar that Greg ever gave me, like one of his early batches. He wrapped it in a gold foil and wrote 2T from, and then he crossed out from and then wrote love, Greg.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, total sap.
Wow. Okay, is there a term for what you do? Like if someone bakes, they're a baker. Is there a technical term for what you do?
Yeah, technically we're chocolate makers. Okay. So a lot of people will be like, oh, chocolatiers. And chocolatiering and chocolate making are actually very different things. A chocolate maker is someone who takes the whole cocoa bean and produces the actual chocolate. A chocolatier takes the chocolate that's already been made by the maker and produces it into like lovely little treats like bonbons and truffles, and they could even be making it into chocolate bars, and but they're not taking the chocolate from bean to the actual chocolate.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Can you tell me about the history of Front Porch Chocolate up to now?
I'll start with the origin story, which was I can't exactly remember what happened, but I disappointed my grandmother one year. I don't know what I don't remember what it was, but I felt like I needed to make it up to her. And so one year for Christmas, I had been making Christmas presents for my family for years. And so one year I was like, I need to make sure that Gammy knows that I really love her. Mm-hmm. And so her favorite food, as far as I knew, was chocolate. And so I thought, well, I'm not going to like buy chocolate chips and then melt it down and put it in a chocolate bar. I'm going to like make it from like scratch, from like cocoa beans, and I'm going to grind it with sugar. So yeah, I was a student at MSU and just had my roommate's Nutribullet and went to Rose Hours and bought some cocoa nibs and some sugar and put it in a blender and blended it up and made this like weird paste. And then that's kind of what started it. I gave it to my family that year for Christmas and they were like, this is great, but like it was like pretty gritty and it was fine. it was like totally fine. But my grandmother was happy. But then I started buying equipment. I bought a book called Making Chocolate from a Chocolate Maker called Dandelion Chocolate in San Francisco. And that's where I really learned how to make chocolate. And I was just tinkering in my house, doing a lot of stuff in the kitchen, in the garage. And COVID happened. I kind of stopped making chocolate. T and I started dating during that time. And I was finishing up school at MSU. Always was interested in chocolate. I started a small chocolate club with just some friends that I was in school with, and we would meet like once a week and just talk about chocolate. And
wow.
I'd pick up some chocolate bars and, you know, some stuff that I had made, and we would talk about it. So I always had a dream of starting a chocolate business, specifically in the Bozeman area. But when I graduated, I wanted to get into software sales. And T kind of sat me down in the parking lot near our house after we'd gotten some tacos. And was like, basically like, I don't think that's a good idea. Like, yes, you could make more money that way, but like in terms of happiness and what you want to do and like our strength as a couple and like, you know, being together and being happy, like we should try this chocolate. I remember she was like, chocolate's good. Like we should try to sell it. And so T got involved and without her, I would have just been in the kitchen sort of tinkering and I think it would have died. But then T brought it back to life and then actually gave it some legs and some, like, traction moving forward to sell it to people.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very cool. Oh, is there, like, a motto or a credo that you guys kind of have adopted for yourself to kind of keep you going, or that you want your business to project?
I think we have a lot of values that we try to keep in mind as we're making things, just to make it the most enjoyable for ourselves, so that we don't get bogged down by all the small business kind of like hubbub and just the grind and the hustle of it. And we started doing it. It is a very romantic thing to make chocolate together. And so we really try to prioritize making it fun for ourselves, making it fun for other people, and really trying to bring out all the creativity. I think that was one thing when Greg was making chocolate that made me feel like you need to keep doing this, was because he's such a creative person and he really showed that through food. And I mean, he would cook for me all the time when we first started dating, and you know, it was just like opening my world to so many different food experiences, and the creativity around that is just like so important. So we just try to keep that top of mind, I would say. It's just nice. Being creative and making sure we remember that it's an art and it's for fun, and it's, that's kind of why we do it. It fulfills us in that way.
And what is unique about Front Porch Chocolate as compared to other chocolate products around?
I mean, for one, we make chocolate. I think that is very unique. There's mm-hmm. not a lot of, yes, there's a lot of chocolate bars that you can buy at the store that are made by makers, but mm-hmm. There's not many that are made in this area. It's a hyper local chocolate bar made from cocoa beans. Mm-hmm. But it also has to do with the quality of the products that we buy. We buy the highest grade of cocoa bean that we can from small producers all around the world. Mm-hmm. And our goal is to highlight the different flavors that those producers create in their cocoa beans that they grow. Mm-hmm. So the thing that we started out with early on was single origin chocolate. So that's just the idea that you can buy cocoa beans from one farm and it have a very specific taste and flavor profile versus buying from a different farm that tastes completely different. So that's still what we do. We still highlight regional differences in flavor. Like we have a Ghana cocoa bean that tastes completely different than our Dominican cocoa bean, for example. So we really try to highlight flavor and really focus on the inherent like flavor qualities of the ingredients themselves. Recently, we've been tiptoeing a little bit away from single origin chocolate. We definitely still make it, but we've been experimenting with. But like right now, we're about to launch a strawberry lemon white chocolate for Valentine's Day. That's pink and has freeze-dried strawberries on it and dark chocolate chunks. And so there's a lot of different things that we can make. But again, the same principles apply. It's how can we buy the highest quality ingredients to really just showcase what things can taste like with minimal intervention. And so I think that's our goal and what sets us apart.
Do you have any future plans? You said you're kind of going into new turf here. Any other future plans for your business or your products?
Yeah, so many. I mean, yeah, so many. I don't know. You know, I think we're really excited to expand the types of chocolate that we make. We really, really, really want to figure out a way to incorporate more local ingredients because chocolate is just a vessel. Mm-hmm. There's so many things that you can do with it. It can take any shape, any form, and it can take on a lot of different flavors. So, and it's beloved. People love it. And so if we can figure out ways to incorporate more local ingredients, I would say the better. That's an overarching goal of ours in the future. But we really just want to expand our production, and we want to expand our educational offerings. We want to have people come in and learn how to make chocolate. We want people to learn how the process is made, because there's a lot that happens behind closed doors. A lot of people, myself included, back before I started making chocolate, a lot of people have no idea how a chocolate bar is made. It's just a thing that's on the shelf. And for something that's so widely consumed, and especially for something that's been consumed for as long as it's been consumed, there's no reason why we shouldn't know how a chocolate bar is made. And so we want to introduce that to people. We want to show people how it's made. And I think, you know, empower people to be more informed shoppers. And yeah, I don't know. That's one piece of it. I don't know. Do you have any other future?
Oh, man. We have so many plans all the time.
Yeah.
For so many different things. I do think the incorporating local ingredients is such a big part of the future goal. And with that, trying to just incorporate more of the community around here, and being able to just work with more businesses in town and have those connections and work with more people who just live down the street from us. And are they growing something cool in their garden? Oh, maybe that's something that we could dry out and put in a chocolate bar. So just kind of opening up the idea that we have a space and we have a product and we are just open to having community collaboration in so many different ways, and not just with farms or local producers per se, but local artists and just people around who have any interest in making chocolate and making fun things.
When you mentioned artists, that makes me think of the wrapping on your chocolate bars. Could you say something about that?
Yeah. So the wrapping on our signature single origin chocolate bars is really special. We came up with it, I think, about 3 or 4 years ago. It was the first packaging idea we had. We were workshopping, you know, how do we make chocolate packaging that is sustainable? And I think that's the question with food packaging all the time, is what are we throwing in the trash? How do we reduce that? And a lot of times we're turning to compostable things or recycled things or recyclable things. And we wanted to see if we could kind of get outside of that, but still with the concept of reusability, sustainability. So we decided to start packaging our signature 70% dark chocolate bars in reusable beeswax wraps. So instead of having packaging that went into the landfill, it was something that someone at home could use again and maybe help eliminate their waste at home with plastic wrap or with tinfoil or parchment paper, whatever they were using as a food wrap in their fridge. So we started making the reusable beeswax wraps with local beeswax, well, I guess regional, up from Power Montana Smoot Honey. We order blocks of beeswax from Mark up there, and he sends them down, and we mix them with our own mixture of jojoba oil and pine rosin, and then we coat fabric, and that's what we wrap all of our bars in. So
they're just beautiful. I gotta say that. I have some.
Okay. Thank you.
And how can people find your products?
In Bozeman, you can find them at a number of places. We're actually going to start doing the Winter Farmers Market here pretty soon. So the Winter Farmers Market, the Summer Farmers Market as well. Mm-hmm. But right now, our retailers are, I hope I can name them all.
Start on the north side.
Wild Crumb, Misha's, Biome Slow Craft, and then I'm just going to jump. Studio Coffee, Joe's Parkway, Steep Mountain Tea.
Vino Pertuti. Single Barrel.
Oh, yeah, Single Barrel.
Genuine Ice Cream. And there's a whole list on our website.
Aurora's French Bakery at Four Corners. I'm sure I'm leaving somebody off. I'm so sorry if I've left you off this list. In Livingston, much more manageable list. It's Cactus Blossom, Gourmet Cellar and Woods Rose Market.
Okay.
And then also online.
And then online, yeah. Online.
Talk about that.
Yeah. So previously, we were working out of a shared commissary kitchen for about 3 years, and we were unable to produce enough chocolate to sell online consistently. And now, with our new space, we're so excited to have more of an online store so people all over can buy our chocolate. If you live in Alaska, if you live in Maine, we've shipped it to all those places. So you can order on frontporchchocolate.com, and then you can find all of our updates for when we launch new products, like our strawberry lemon bar. We post all of that on Instagram and Facebook, so at Front Porch Chocolate.
Okay, and is there any question you wish I would have asked that I haven't?
I think something that is kind of hard for a lot of people to wrap their minds around with small businesses is how they get funding and how they are actually able to support themselves and begin their business. I think it's really an intimidating process, especially when you're looking at something like chocolate and manufacturing and you need equipment and things like that. And we are trying to be transparent about how we've been able to fund our business, and so people can get the idea that, oh, maybe they can do it themselves, or, oh, that's what it's realistically like. And so, yeah, I think that that question of just how, like, how you got money to start it is one that I would answer. And for us, we started out just with our own personal funds. So Greg had been buying hobby equipment that was like, I don't know, maybe worth a couple hundred, a few hundred dollars for a roaster. And
whoa, way more than that.
Okay.
At least $600.
$600 with his hobby equipment. And then we put about $7,000 of our own money into kind of upgrading some of our packaging and buying more machines. And then,
which was over time too.
Which was over time.
Like, yeah, it was like a very gradual.
That was about over like another year. So very growing stages. And then just this year, in order to secure having our own facility, we took out a business loan for $50,000 and a personal friend family loan of $5,000. Mm-hmm. So just to put it in perspective, like this year, just to start this space, we took about $55,000 out in loans and financed a lot of it through credit cards also. So that was kind of how our cash flow worked to get us here.
Nice. Yeah. I think that might be really helpful to other people, other listeners that might be looking at starting their own business. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's when I was sitting around thinking about starting my own business, which I've been thinking about for like over a decade, I never understood how you did it. I was so confused how these things came to be. Obviously every business is super different, but chocolate was interesting because you can, and I think this is why we're seeing a lot more small chocolate businesses pop up, because you can start with very little. Mm-hmm. You can buy a $300 grinder, and you can buy, actually, for the most part, that's all you need. You need a $300 grinder and like a hair dryer and an oven, and off you go. You can start making chocolate very quickly. So the question then becomes, how do you scale it? Which is where we're at right now. But we've gotten it to the point where we can, like, you can, with $300, you can start to build a business. And then eventually, though, like as T was talking about, there is that you do need to like get that extra cash to be able to pay contractors and get the space and buy the equipment that you need. So yeah, it's a really murky world. I think chocolate making is murky, but starting businesses is also murky, and that we hope that we can reduce a little bit of the murkiness in both of those. Yeah. If we can.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you. We have a couple nature readings for this week from Nature, A Day at a Time, from author, illustrator, and naturalist Kathy Katz. February 2nd. The quote that begins this entry is that people often change their sexual behavior during their lifetimes, making it impossible to state that a particular set of behaviors defines a person as gay. And that's from Masters and Johnson on Sex and Human Loving. And this is a little side note from me. Though I'm celebrating marmots this week, the entry for today from Nature A Day at a Time is about skunks. And Kathy writes, skunks are generally solitary, but females sometimes winter together in underground dens. In early spring, males and females get together to mate, but return to their solitary lifestyle after mating. Females give birth, usually in May, to 4 to 8 blind, hairless kittens. Many females seek a sexual relationship with a male in the spring, but sometime during the summer, they return to the company of females. Female pairing can be sexual or platonic, and many females remain solitary throughout the year. And then she closes with a quote from Bruce Bagamil in Biological Exuberance. And Bruce writes, animals of the same sex build nests and homes together, and many homosexual pairs raise young without members of the opposite sex. Other animals regularly have partners of both sexes, and some even live in communal groups where sexual activity is common among all members, male and female. Amid this incredible variety of different patterns, one thing is certain. The animal kingdom is most definitely not just heterosexual. The entry for February 3rd continues, because they are programmed to become active at dusk, skunks are vulnerable to a few other night animals, also on the prowl for food. Most creatures steer clear of skunks, but the great horned owl, the skunk's main predator, attacks with no regard for the skunk's potent spray. Evidently, they are immune to the smell. Similarly, some humans can't smell the skunk's offending odor, and some even claim they find it appealing. Do skunks ever spray each other? Yes, but usually accidentally when one is in the path of another one in the midst of defense. Young skunks at about 6 weeks follow their mother single file into the woods to forage for food, taking the same route every night. They dig through dirt with their snouts, searching for insects. Little sneezes from skunks can be heard through the night as they clear their noses from dirt that gets clogged in their nostrils. Mothers are protective of their kittens during the early weeks and assume all the training and feeding responsibilities. Contact with the father ends after mating. Her relationship with a male doesn't begin again until the young are on their own. My thanks to Ken Lane and Red, Blue, Black, Silver for sharing their work on Desert Oracle Radio. Thank you, T and Greg at Front Porch Chocolate, for your time. Thanks to KGVM and its supporters, and thank you for listening. If you want to reach me, the number is 406-404-6246. You can hear this program live on the air at 95.9 FM Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgvm.org at 7 Sunday nights and 9 Monday mornings. Our past shows are also available on demand on the kgbm.org website. And by the way, you can hear more about St. Brigid on Desert Oracle Radio Replay, episode number 53, titled Blesses St. Minerva. I'll be back next week with more desert and mountain lore for you. Till then, stay well and sweet dreams. Some sounds from Sacagawea Park in Livingston to take us out. It's always windy over there, but it's a good wind.